Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Tonight we're talking about the Clemency Project. Help me with this, Ms. Rose Berry. You said there's a number behind that, and it makes a difference. Explain that real quick. Clemency Project.
2014-2014.
As in the year?
Yes.
Ah, there we go. Let me start again. Clemency Project 2014. We're talking about the release of Everett Law. My guests are Mr. Law. He's sitting right next to me, just released from federal prison. His wife, Kim Law, joins us now. Professor Josephine Ross with the Howard University School of Law, and attorney Cynthia Rose Berry, project manager of the Clemency Project 2014. Lines are open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Before I go back to the phone lines, briefly, Professor Ross, talk to me about an event that is happening on tomorrow.
Thank you. Howard University School of Law is having an event on sentencing and clemency, and it is going to include Mr. Law talking more, Kim Law here, and two other experts to give us the full background and understand exactly what is going on in the federal criminal system.
Specifically, when and where is that?
12:30 to 1:30 at the law school. The law school is at the Van Ness Red Line stop.
Okay, thank you so much. I want to go back to the question that I asked attorney Cynthia Rose Berry before we took a break, and how did you connect with Mr. Law, and how does the project connect with others? Because, as we said in the beginning, there were some, 42 or 43 involved in the clemency measure that the president signed, but there are tens of thousands of applicants for this.
That's right. We have over 36,000 applicants. The Bureau of Prisons surveyed everyone for us, and so we took everyone who asked us for help, because one of the criterion is that you have to be serving a federal sentence. As you imagine, we had a number of folks serving state sentences who came to us. So those folks, you know, could come out of the pile. But all of the others were filtered through the criteria announced by the Department of Justice under President Obama's Clemency Initiative. And so we didn't turn anybody away unless and until we discerned that they didn't appear to meet the criteria.
So, I mean, did you have to meet him? How did that work? Did you go sit down at the prison? How does it work?
She assigns us.
Okay.
And then we take it from there.
So how did that happen?
So we gathered the documents and based on a review, even of the reports themselves, you could tell that it looked like it met the criteria. So it's very dry in some ways. And it's a learning curve, not only for law students, but for lawyers that are not familiar with the federal system. And you start chipping away at all those enhancements, because what they do is they pile on. You start with the 10 years, it turns into 20, and then he did this at one time, he did that in another time, and there were problems all along the way. We tried to get in touch with his lawyer. His lawyer had been disbarred.
Wow.
And what some people don't know, for example, is a sentence could be increased if someone went to trial, took the stand, and was found guilty. Their sentence could be increased for an obstruction of justice.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I mean, our federal system is extremely punitive, and that's how these sentences got to be so high.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Garland, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, good afternoon to everyone.
Hey, how are you? Go right ahead.
Okay. My name is Garland L. Foster. I'm a Washingtonian, but I live in Maryland. But my question is that what happens to the people that's actually innocent, that's convicted of crimes that did not commit? They serve time for this crime, then be released back into the general public, and they label as a felon. And they're looking for people to help them to get this off their record. But no one helps them or accepts them in society. So how does that work for the people that actually serve time and be released back into the public?
So this initiative is not for those who are innocent. Neil Eggleston, White House counsel, has said, the president says, that this is about correcting a sentence and not about those who didn't commit the crimes. The Office of Pardon Attorney, if it's a federal crime, is the office that handles a pardon, and that's what would be necessary for someone who's innocent, is to go back and have their record or the record of that conviction cleared through a pardon. Those applications are not ones that we handle, and there are lawyers in the community who handle pardon applications.
Professor Ross, did you have something you wanted to add about that?
The Innocence Project. There are a couple of law schools that have wonderful innocence projects. So in, Georgetown does right in D.C.
Thank you so much for your phone call, Garland. Let's talk to Mrs. Law. Okay. Kim, thanks for joining me, first of all. You met Everett, you know, while he was incarcerated. And you two have been married for what, how long now?
5 years.
5 years. So even during the course of the 5 years, and I dare say particularly the last, two or so years, what has that been like moving through this process?
Moving through this process was, you know, he was still hanging with the life sentence until we could go through the process. And the Clemency Project 214, along with Professor Ross and the students, they actually, you know, took on his, you know, his thing and put it all in motion. So going through, it was still like the hope and the prayers that it would get to the point to where they could turn that life sentence. Because me on a hold, I tried to call attorneys to see if we could go through, because once I found out about the attorney that he originally had.
The one who was disbarred.
The one that, mm-hmm. that was disbarred. And then listening to what he was telling me, and I was like, I asked him, why did you take that plea? Because I never would have. But when he insisted that, he said he would only do 20 years. He said, I'll just do the 20 years and be done. But then other things was added on. So that's what gave the life sentence.
For you personally, talk to me about your life just before and just after you realized that your husband was going to be released.
My whole life, it just went, I cried. I mean, it was so like, is this real? I had to go really and take a walk. And as I was walking, I was talking with God. And I mean, I'm literally crying. And I'm like, I couldn't have never imagined that between the Clemency Project, Professor Ross, the students, that they could come into a person's life and then just make something real. Because it was so far-fetched that it was like, you can't give up. And then me trying to stay strong for him, trying to keep him positive, trying to keep him motivated, trying to keep myself motivated and keep me in a place where I can't give up. Mm-hmm. And then once the news came, it was just tears, just tears.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Charlene, calling from Baltimore. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. I'd like to know what recourse is available for those individuals that are in the exact same situation. However, it's on, like, the local or state level. It's not, you know, federal, so, you know, wouldn't be that project, but these are individuals that have done the same thing, gotten such harsh, harsh sentences, and but they're in state prison.
So for state prisoners, the governor has the authority to grant clemency for a state charge. The quagmire is in D.C. There is no governor in D.C. The charges are state charges. And the question is whether the president has the authority or
because the mayor does not.
That's right. Mm-hmm. To grant clemency to those folks. But in state courts, the governor has the power to grant clemency.
Okay. So in that process is similar to just someone applying, it's an application process, or how does that process take place?
I'm not an expert in that area. I would say that you'd need to do a little bit of research, and maybe some of the law schools might have some state clemency projects. I'm not sure, but I wouldn't want to speak out of turn.
Professor Ross?
I would just say it varies state by state.
Yeah, and for some reason, and you know, I'm not exactly sure about this, Charlene, but for some reason, I believe the UB, the University of Baltimore School of Law, may be a good starting point as it relates to that. Just something just, that may be a starting point. I'm not exactly sure, but I think that may be a good starting point if you have more questions about that. Okay. But thank you so much. Let me go back to the phone lines, 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Arnold, calling from Northwest D.C., what's on your mind?
Yes, my name is Arnold Rice.
Mm-hmm.
I had a question for Ms. Rosemary.
Go ahead.
Ms. Rosemary, I'm an identical twin brother that's incarcerated with a life sentence. At the time of his sentence, the pre-sentence report asked for 168 months to 210, and the judge ended up giving him life with no parole for some prior charges that happened 35 years ago and 40 years ago. And she sent me a letter saying that she didn't know whether they're going to be able to get to his case, to assign him an attorney by the time the administration was out. But we got an attorney. We submitted the petition maybe 6 or 7 months ago, and we're working on a supplement petition with Georgetown University Law School.
Well, Arnold, let me ask you quickly, what's your question? We've got some other folks on the line.
My question is, if your petition is in, are all the petitions that are being reviewed now going to be decided before this administration is over with?
So first, let me say I'm sorry about your brother and the sentence that he was given, the unjust sentence that he was given.
I thank you very much for that.
You're welcome. Deputy Attorney General Sally Yates recently said that the Department of Justice was committed to reviewing all of the petitions that were for drug offenders that had been submitted. And that's the most I could tell you. Our project is outside of the Department of Justice, and we're hustling to get all of them over. But she has said very publicly that they are committed to reviewing all of the petitions that have been submitted.
Okay. Arnold, thank you so much for your phone call. When you say hustling to get them over, how many are we talking about here?
So we have to go through all of the 36,000 applicants. We've gone through a majority of them. We've submitted about 2,000 petitions, and there are a number left in various stages of our process now.
30,000. How do you do that?
Well, we had a really good assistant project manager who is a technical expert, and he built a database. Of course, the only way to handle something like this is to use technology. So he built a database through which the applications travel.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I wanted to ask Mr. Law also, what are your plans now? You've been away for more than two decades. I find the unfortunate irony is that that VCR crime that really caused some problematic things regarding sentencing is that nobody uses VCRs anymore.
Yeah.
And I think that's that in and itself is just interesting. You've got a supportive, wonderful wife here, and you've come out with not rebuilding but building your life. How are you going to do that?
Well, I got a job working on the train, and just staying out the way. And I appreciate my wife for everything. And like I said, you got a lot of good guys that locked up, that don't deserve life. I hope, that everybody come out that, that don't have no violent crime.
Mm-hmm. Kim, what are your plans, for him? Because the truth of the matter is wives always have plans. Whether you know it or not, Everett, your plans really don't matter. But so just give me the rundown, Kim. What are the next steps, for both of you as you help him, build his life and to reorient himself to a world that did not exist when he went away some 22, 23 years ago?
Yes, with that being said, with him, it feels like when he went in, He was in one world, but we're in another world now. We have technology. We have the different types of things, even, you know, the cell phones. And, you know, he had made a comment. And I think he was joking, but he was like, they had phones in a bag when I was out here. Mm-hmm. So, you know.
Heavy ones.
Yeah. Right. So he made that, you know, he made that right. comment to me. And, I mean, I'm standing there and I was like.
Phones in a bag. What are you
yes,
talking about? Exactly.
But yeah. mm-hmm. with that being said, it's, you know, reorientating and just being patient. And, you know, you got to just help him through and show him that it's going to be okay. Mm-hmm. And long as he has me, you know, there and has supportive family around that, you know, he's going to be just fine to just get himself, you know, acclimated back. It's going to take a little while. But, you know, the first start was, you know, he did get a job. So he has a job and he's working and, you know, just getting back into the program of, you know, with the children, with his children, you know, he's around my children because we, you know, we're in Kentucky. So he's around my children, whereas his children are in Virginia, but they're more than, you know, to come. And I want him to see. So we're going to be traveling back to Virginia so that he can actually get orientated all back over and just get back out there and just stand, you know, like you said, he wants to. On the positive note.
Yeah, and the best thing is, look, you got a job, man, because so many guys coming out, whether it's through clemency, release, whatever, find it so difficult to find a job in the first place. So that is a first big step. I need to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk to Bobby in North Carolina and Richard in Fort Washington, 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. We continue our conversation about the Clemency Project 2014 and the release of Everett Law. I want to go back to the phone lines. Let's talk to Richard calling from Fort Washington. Richard, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hello.
Hey, how are you?
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I initially had another question, but when I heard the gentleman's wife indicate that he was in Kentucky, I changed my question to wonder if he was a person like myself that had a drug problem back in the 80s. And then when I got caught up in the criminal justice system, in my personal opinion, I felt that the court-appointed lawyer I had tried to railroad me. But what saved me was I had been a veteran from the Vietnam era. And that's how I caught a break. But, I mean, if, you know... I just wanted to congratulate him for having faith that, you know, even though it looked bleak, that, you know, that God saw fit for him to get out. And I hope that President Obama and along with the law center that you have on can help do something, because I can see a resurgence of that type of mindset going into the new this new idea of marijuana being legalized and people thinking that they can, the law enforcement think they can get people locked up forever.
Hmm. Okay. Well, thank you so much for that comment, Richard. I think he makes an interesting point, something that there's been a lot of discussion about very, very recently, particularly as it relates to what's happening in Washington State, Colorado, medical marijuana, recreational use of marijuana here. And not so much the discussion about marijuana, but, you know, crimes that were crimes and no longer are to a certain degree. What impact do you think that clemency or other projects like this may have if, for example, there are the loosening of or decriminalization of marijuana, for example? Do you foresee the release of more people who were incarcerated because of it?
Well, we certainly saw the release of more people when the United States Sentencing Commission changed the level of incarceration for crack versus powder cocaine in the drugs minus two era. I think it's important to understand that right now, although some states have decriminalized marijuana, marijuana is still illegal
federally.
Under the federal system. And so while I think you may see fewer prosecutions, it's still possible that there will be prosecutions under this system. And it's also important to understand what happened, how we got here. You usually had someone who had a couple of state court convictions. convictions, right? Maybe even for marijuana. And then on that third conviction, the feds took that up. And that's how we got those draconian sentences, because those folks were sentenced under the federal system. So we need to change the mindset and what the feds aim at when they consider prosecuting folks under these laws.
Professor Ross, talk to me a little bit about the experience of moving through this process with the students. Obviously, very, very new for them. What was the thing, or what were the things that struck you most about this?
They were so surprised that he could be doing life where they couldn't figure out why that was. They kept digging through the record, like, why did he get life? One of my students is now a prosecutor. She goes into that with this knowledge about how insane these drug laws are. And I think in answer to the question that you posed about marijuana, as people start to realize that marijuana is decriminalized, it becomes even more insane to think about all the people of color that we have locked up for marijuana and for other drugs, too. And so, yes, the cocaine versus crack disparity, that's there. But that in general, there's disparity basically on who gets stopped and frisked and whose car gets searched at the time that you stop for driving while black. So we have this whole system where the people who are serving time for drugs, so many of them are people of color.
That's right. Who get charged with what? Who sits before whom? Who serves on that jury? Who convicts that person? All of that is more heavily incurred by people of color and poor people.
Bobby, calling from North Carolina. Thanks for calling, Bobby. What's on your mind?
I appreciate what you guys are doing and coming up talking about the Clemson Law. I'm from a part of North Carolina called Ahoskie. And what this guy is talking about, I witnessed that in that area with young guys getting caught with very little and had no record at all. None drug violent crimes. I had one guy that was just incarcerated 3 years back because he didn't take the plea bargain. And he was, somebody said that they had bought 7 grams of cocaine from him, powder. And they never caught him. He had never hit a drug charge. But they gave him, I think, 14 to 20 years. And you see a lot of that in that area because they say, like, they go back and talk to some of the inmates into the federal penitentiary that was incarcerated 5 years before they even arrested him. Mm-hmm. And they said they were buying dope from him to lessen their sentences. But they never caught these guys with anything, but they still arrested them and charged them with what the person on the inside said. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering something about that. And you see a lot of them getting locked up in that area, young black men.
So let me be. What's your question, Bobby? I need a little more clarity from you.
Okay, it was a guy
I think he's talking about snitching, right? I think he's talking about people giving information to reduce their own sentences.
Or confidential informants and the like. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they was incarcerated like 5 years before. And they sent a guy, they said, to him to buy drugs, but they never got the drugs, but they still charged him with selling the guy 7 grams of drugs and gave him 14 to 20 years.
Okay.
This has to do with wrongful convictions. One of the major reasons why people are incarcerated that shouldn't be at all, who are innocent, is because somebody gets on the stand and lies about it.
I see.
And jurors don't believe that people get on the stand and lie. Mm-hmm. But people get on the stand and lie to save their own skins.
Well, Bobby, thank you for sharing that with me. Professor Ross, I wanted to drill down just a little bit more. You spoke about, you know, some of the things that struck the students. What about you? As a person who is, you know, charged with, you know, guiding these young defense attorneys, lawyers and prosecutors and the like. What was the thing about this that struck you?
Well, I was a public defender for 7 years, so I had seen many rap sheet way longer than his. So I kept looking for the other pages, too. I'm like, what? This is it? Couldn't believe it. And I think within week two, when I finally got the discovery, I'm like, this man is getting out. I just kept emailing him saying, don't worry, you are going to get out. We are going to figure this thing out. And then it was another language because, you know, the language of how to be a trial attorney is so different from the language of writing one of these petitions. So Cynthia and her group helped me enormously, and then I passed on with what they taught me to my students.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Roseberry, what does this portend for others like Mr. Law down the road? Do you see a light at the end of the tunnel? More releases? Do you think that, looking in your lawyerly crystal ball, after November 8th, do you think that things are going to change, or do you think hopefully they will continue to get better?
Well, I certainly hope so. I think that what we've seen is the beginning of hope. And Mr. Law talked about that, and Kim talked about that as well, that folks now have hope. Brian Stevens, when he talks about changing or tackling a problem, he talks about changing the narrative around the problem. And I think that's what the president has done. He's changed the narrative around who should be in prison and how long and how it's safe for people to come back home. You heard Mr. Law talk about, there are people I left behind. This selfless comment, even while he sits here just out of prison, many of the people I've talked with are concerned about the people they left behind. These are beautiful people who made a mistake and deserve a second chance. And I think we're beginning to see the change of that narrative around incarceration.
And you speak about Brian Stevens, the attorney who recently celebrated for getting an innocent man out of prison. Remember that name, Brian Stevens. There's a movie coming out about his book. Interesting and certainly worthy of paying attention to. I want to thank Kim Law, Everett Law, Professor Ross, and of course, Ms. Roseberry. Thank you all so much. And again, you know, God bless you, Everett. Good luck to you. And, you know, if I wish you all could have seen the look on his wife's face. I tell you, she broke her jaw smiling. So we hope that there are many more smiles for both of you.
Thank you, sir, for having me.
You're quite welcome.
Ms. Roseberry and Ms. Rose, thank you all very much.
Well, that is the Daily Drum on Sirius XM for this Wednesday, October 19th. I'm Harold Fisher.